in their respective notebooks, and Prout seemed quite comfortable with her. I didn't have time to join them, but she told me later some of the things they had discussed. For instance, they had been comparing the Earth with K-Pax, and one of the questions she had asked him, in a brash attempt to track down my patient's origins, was where he would like to live if he could live anywhere on Earth. She was hoping he would say Olympia, Washington, or some such town in the Upper West. Instead, he answered, Sweden.
Why Sweden? She wanted to know.
Because it's the country most like K-Pax. The subject then turned to those human beings who seemed most like K-Paxians to him. Here's what he said. Henry Thoreau, Mohandas Gandhi, Albert Schweitzer, John Lennon, and Jane Goodall.
Can you imagine a world full of Schweitzers?
She hooted. I said, John Lennon?
Have you ever heard Imagine?
I told her I would look it up. Then she said something I had been wondering myself.
You know what else? I think he can talk to animals.
I said I wasn't surprised. I had no time for them that afternoon because I was on my way to Ward 4, where Russell was trying to get in. Apparently distraught with the loss of his followers to Prout's counsel and advice and his failure to wake up the catatonic patients, he had decided to convert some of the psychopaths. When I arrived, I found the nurses attempting to get him to go back to his own ward. He was up on his toes, shouting through the little barred window high in the steel door.
Take heed that no man deceiveth you, for many shall cometh in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and shall deceiveth many.
Apparently his words were not falling on deaf ears, as I could hear laughter coming from inside. But he kept on yelling, even after I pleaded with him to go back to Ward 2. I ordered a shot of Thorazine and had him taken back to his room. That same day, two other things happened which I should have paid more attention to. First, I got a report that Howie had asked one of the residents how to perform a tracheotomy. Dr. Chakraborty finally told him, thinking Howie was going to show Ernie how easily he could be saved, even if he were to get choked on something, despite the unfortunate example of his mother's demise. The other event concerned Maria. One of her alters, a sultry female called Chiquita, somehow got into Ward 3 and, before anyone discovered her presence there, offered herself to Wacky. But the results were the same as with the prostitute prescribed earlier. Facing this unexpected rejection, Chiquita quickly exited and Maria appeared. Finding herself with a naked man, engaged in self-manipulation, Maria became hysterical, and she, too, turned the controls over to someone else. Maria herself didn't reappear for several days. On the lighter side, Chuck presented Prout with a drawing summarizing his assessment of the human race, one of many attempts, I discovered, to impress Prout so that he would take Chuck to K-Pax with him. Purely by coincidence, this diagram described almost perfectly our second applicant for the position of permanent director. He obviously had not bathed in weeks or even months. A blizzard of dandruff snowed from his head and drifted onto his shoulders. His teeth seemed to be covered with lichen, and like the previous candidate, Dr. Choate, who checked his fly every few minutes, the man came with excellent references. Session 11. I was gazing out the window at a croquet match on the lawn below when Prout came in for his next interview. I nodded toward the fruit basket and asked him what sorts of games he had played as a boy.
"We don't have games on K-Pax," he replied. "We don't need them."
"Nor what you call jokes," he added, scrutinizing a dried fig. "I've noticed that human beings laugh a lot, even at things that aren't funny. I was puzzled by this at first until I understood how sad your lives really are." I was sorry I had asked. "By the way, this fig has a pesticide residue on it."
"How do you know that?"
"I can see it."
"See it?" Oh, I had forgotten about his ultraviolet vision. With time at a premium, I nonetheless could not resist the opportunity to ask him what our world looked like from his perspective.
in response, he spent nearly 15 minutes trying to describe an incredibly beautiful visage of vibrantly colored flowers, birds, and even ordinary rocks, which lit up like gems for him. The sky itself took on a shimmering, bright violet aura through his eyes. It appeared that Prout's vista was tantamount to being permanently high on one or another psychedelic drug. I wondered whether Van Gogh had not enjoyed the same experience. He had put down the offensive fig while he expounded on his exceptional faculty, and found one more to his liking. While he masticated, I carefully proceeded. "Last time, under hypnosis, you told me about a friend of yours, an earth being, and his father's death, and his butterfly collection, and some other things. Do you remember any of that now?"
"No."
"Well, did you have such a friend?"
"Yes."
"Is he still a friend of yours?"
"Of course."
"Why didn't you tell me about him before?"
"You never asked."
"I see. Where is he now, do you know?"
"He's waiting. I'm going to take him back to Capax with me. That is, if he still wants to go. He vacillates a lot."
"And where is your friend waiting?"
"He's in a safe place."
"Do you know where that is?"
"Certainly."
"Can you tell me?"
"Nay, nay."
"Why not?"
"Because he asked me not to tell anyone."
"Can you at least tell me his name?"
"Sorry."
Given the circumstances, I decided to take a chance. "Prout, I'm going to tell you something you may find hard to believe."
"Nothing you humans come up with surprises me anymore."
"You and your friend are the same person. That is, you and he are separate and distinct identities of the same person." He seemed genuinely shocked.
"That is patently absurd."
"It's true." Annoyed now, but under control.
"Is that another of those beliefs that passes for truth with your species?"
It had been a long shot, and it had missed. There was no way to prove the contention, and no point in wasting any more time. When he had finished his snack, I asked if he was ready to be hypnotized again. He nodded suspiciously, but by the time I had counted to three, he was already gone. I began. "Last time you told me about your Earth friend, beginning with his father's death, do you remember?"
"Yes."
Prout was trans-anamnestic. He could remember previous hypnotic sessions, but only while in the hypnotic state. "Good. Now I want you to think back once again, but not so far back as last time. You and your friend are high school seniors, 12th graders. What do you see?" At this point, Prout slouched down in his chair, fiddled with his nails, and began to chew on an imaginary piece of gum.
"I never was a high school senior," he said. "I never went to school."
"Why not?"
"We don't have schools on Capax."
"What about your friend? Does he go to school?"
"Yes, he does, the dope. I couldn't talk him out of it."
"Why would you want to talk him out of it?"
"Are you kidding? Schools are a total waste of time. They try to teach you a bunch of crap."
"Like what?"
"Like how great America is, better than any other country. How you have to have wars to protect your freedoms. All kinds of junk like that."
"Does your friend feel the same way you do about that?"
"Nah, he believes all that garbage. They all do."
"Is your friend there with you now?"
"Yes."
"Can he hear us?"
"Of course, he's right here."
"May I speak with him?" Again, the momentary hesitation.
"He doesn't want to."
"If he changes his mind, will you let me know?"
"I guess."
"Will he tell me his name, at least?"
"No way."
"Well, we have to call him something. How about Pete?"
"That's not his name, but okay."
"All right, is he a senior now?"
"Yep."
"What year is it?"
1974.
"How old are you?"
137.
"And how old is Pete?"
17.
Does he know you come from K-Pax?
Yes.
How does he know that?
I told him.
What was his reaction to that?
He thinks it's cool.
Incidentally, how did you learn to speak English so well? Did he teach you?
Nah, it's not very difficult. You should try speaking...
Where did you land when you came to Earth?
You mean this trip?
Yes.
China.
Not Zaire?
Why should I land on Zaire when China was pointing toward K-Pax?
Do you have any other Earth friends? Is there anyone else there with you?
Nobody here but us chickens.
How many chickens are you?
Just me and him.
Tell me more about Pete. What's he like?
What's he like? So he's all right. Kinda quiet. Keeps to himself. He's not as smart as I am, but that doesn't matter on Earth.
No. And what does matter?
All that matters is that you're a nice guy and not too bad-looking.
And is he?
I suppose.
Can you describe him?
Yes.
Please do.
He wears his hair combed back into ducktails. He has brown eyes, medium complexion, and 28 pimples, which he puts Clarisil on all the time.
Are his eyes sensitive to bright light?
Not particularly. Why should they be?
What makes him a nice guy?
He smiles a lot. He helps the dumber kids with their assignments. He volunteers to set up the bleachers for the home game, stuff like that. He's vice president of the class. Everybody likes him.
You sound as though you're not so sure they should.
I know him better than anybody else.
And you think he's not as nice as everybody thinks?
He's not as nice as he makes out.
In what way?
He has a temper. It gets out of hand sometimes.
What happens when it gets out of hand?
He gets mad, throws things around, kicks inanimate objects.
What makes him mad?
Things that seem unfair, that he can't do anything about, you know.
I was pretty sure I did know. It had something to do with the helplessness and anger he felt at the time of his father's death. Can you give me an example?
One time he found a kid beating up on a smaller kid. The older guy was a big, red-headed bully, and everybody hated him. He had broken the other kid's glasses and his nose, too, I think. My friend beat the shit out of him. I tried to stop him, but he wouldn't listen.
What happened then? Was the bully badly hurt? Did he try to get even later on?
He lost a couple of teeth, is all. He was mostly afraid my friend would tell everybody what happened. When he didn't, and asked the little kid not to either, they became the best of buddies, all three of them.
What do these other guys think about you?
They don't know about me.
Does anyone besides your friend know about you?
Not a soul.
All right. Back to your friend. Does this anger of his show itself very often?
Not that often. Hardly ever at school.
Does he ever get mad at his mother and sisters?
Never. He doesn't see his sisters much. They're already married and gone. One of them moved away.
Tell me about his mother.
She's nice. She works at the school, at the cafeteria. She doesn't make much money, but she does a lot of gardening and canning. They have enough to eat, but not much else. And she's still trying to pay back all of his dad's doctor bills.
Where do they live? I mean, is it a house? What kind of neighborhood is it in?
It's a small three-bedroom house. It looks like all the others on the street.
What sorts of things does your friend do for entertainment? Movies, books, television?
There's only one movie theater in town. They have an old TV set that doesn't work half the time. My friend reads a lot, and he also likes to walk around in the woods.
Why?
He wants to be a biologist.
What about his grades?
What about him?
Does he get good grades?
A's and B's. He should do better. He sleeps too much. What are his best subjects? He's pretty good in Latin and science. Not so hot in English and math.
Is he a good athlete?
He's on the wrestling team.
Is he planning to go to college?
He was until a few days ago.
What happened? Is there a problem?
Yes.
Is that why he called you?
Yes.
Does he call you often now?
Once in a while.
And what is the problem? Money? There are scholarships available, or...
It's more complicated than that.
How so?
He has a girlfriend.
And she doesn't want him to go.
It's more complicated than that.
Can you tell me about it? After a brief pause, possibly for consultation with his friend...
She's pregnant.
Oh, I see.
Happens all the time.
And he feels he has to marry her.
Unfortunately.
He shrugged. Unfortunately, because he won't be able to go to college.
That and the religion problem.
What's the religion problem?
She's a Catholic.
You don't like Catholics?
It's not that I dislike Catholics or any other group defined by its superstitious beliefs. It's that I know what's going to happen.
What's going to happen?
He's going to settle down in this company town that killed his father, and he's going to have a bunch of kids that nobody will associate with because their mother is a Catholic.
Where is this town?
I told you he doesn't want me to tell you that.
I thought he might have changed his mind.
When he makes up his mind about something, nobody can change it.
He sounds pretty strong-willed.
About some things.
What, for example?
About her.
Who, his girlfriend?
Yep.
I may be dense, but I still don't see why her being a Catholic is such a serious problem.
That's because you don't live here. Her family lives on the wrong side of the tracks, literally.
Maybe they will be able to overcome the problem.
How?
She could change her faith. They could move away.
Not a chance. She's too attached to her family.
Do you hate her?
Me? I don't hate anyone. I hate the chains people shackle themselves with.
Like religion.
Religion, family responsibilities, having to make a living, all that stuff. It's so... stifling, don't you think?
Sometimes, but they're things we have to learn to live with, aren't they?
Not me.
Why not?
We don't have all that crap on K-Pax.
Will you be going back there soon?
Any time now.
How long do you usually stay on Earth?
Depends. A few days, usually. Just long enough to help him over the rough spots.
All right, now listen carefully. I'm going to ask you to come forward in time several days, let's say 2 weeks. Where are you now?
On K-Pax.
Good. What do you see?
A forest with lots of soft places to lie down on, and fruit trees and all kinds of other beings wandering around.
Much like the kind of forest your friend enjoys hiking in?
Well, something like that, but nobody is bulldozing it down to build a shopping center.
Tell me about some of the plants and animals in the woods there on K-Pax. I was curious to find out whether the young Prote had a fully developed concept of his home planet, or whether that came later. While he was describing the flora and fauna, I retrieved his file and pulled out the information that Prote had divulged to me in sessions 5 through 8. I quizzed him on the names of grains, fruits, and vegetables, the various animal beings, even about light travel and the K-Paxian calendar. I won't repeat the questions and answers here, but they confirmed my suspicion that the creation of his alien world was developed over many years. For example, he could tell me the names of only 6 grains at this stage. Our time ran out just as Prote decided to make a trip to one of the K-Paxian libraries. He asked me whether I would like to join him. I said I was sorry. I had some appointments.
It's your loss, he said. After I had awakened him and before he left my examining room, I asked Prout whether he could, in fact, talk to animals, as Giselle and I suspected.
"Of course," he replied.
"Can you communicate with all our beings?"
"I have a little difficulty with Homo sapiens."
"Can you talk to dolphins and whales?"
"They're beings, aren't they?"
"How do you do that?"
He wagged his head in abject frustration. "You humans consider yourselves the smartest of the Earth beings. Am I right?"
"Yes."
"Then obviously the other beings speak much simpler languages than yours, right?"
"Well..." Out came the notebook, pencil poised.
"So if you're so smart and their languages are so simple, how come you can't communicate with them?"
He waited for an answer. Unfortunately, I didn't have one. Just before I left for the day, Giselle gave me another discouraging report from the police. Her contact had come up with a list of all disappearances of white males born between 1950 and 1965 from the entire U.S. and Canada during the last 10 years. There had been thousands during this period, of course, but not a single one even came close to matching Prout's profile. Some were too tall, some were bald, some were blue-eyed, some were dead. Some had been found and were accounted for. Unless Prout were a female in disguise, was much older or younger than he seemed, or someone whose disappearance had not been noticed, our patient, for all practical purposes, did not exist. She had also found out how many slaughterhouses there were in the United States and Canada, and was waiting for a list of their names and locations. "You can eliminate the ones in or near large cities," I told her. "There's only one movie theater." She nodded her acknowledgement. She looked tired.
"I'm going to go home and sleep for about 2 days," she said, yawning. How I wished I could have done the same.
I was lying awake that night, trying to make some sense of the day's events. Why, I wondered hazily, was there no record of Pete's disappearance? And what good, I tried to reason, was a list of slaughterhouses without further information as to where our abattoir might be located? When I got a call from Dr. Chakraborty, Ernie was in the clinic. Someone had tried to kill him.
"What? Who?"
I barked.
"Howie,"
came the chilling reply. All I could think of as I sped down the expressway was, Jesus Christ, what have I done? Whatever happened to Ernie was my fault, my responsibility, just as I was responsible for everything else that happened at the hospital. It was one of the worst moments of my life, but even at that blackest of hours, I was heartened by the glow of the city, her throbbing lights bright against the steel-gray background of the dawning sky, as full of defiant life as the night, some 40 years earlier, that we futilely rushed my father to the hospital some 40 years earlier. Same glowing sky, same darkening guilt. Ernie was still in the emergency room when I got to MPI. Dr. Chakraborty met me in the corridor with,
"You are not to worry. He is very fine."
And indeed he was sitting up in bed, sans mask, smiling, his hands behind his head. "How are you feeling, Ernie?"
"Wonderful, absolutely wonderful."
I had never seen a smile quite like his. It was positively beatific. "What happened, for God's sake?"
"My good friend Howie just about strangled me to death."
When he threw his head back to laugh, I could see a red abrasion where something had been wrapped around his neck.
"That old son of a bitch, I love him."
"Love him? He tried to kill you."
"No, he didn't. He made me think he tried to kill me. Oh, it was fantastic. I was asleep, you know, with my hands tied and everything. He wrapped something around my neck, a handkerchief or something, and tightened it up, and there wasn't a damn thing I could do about it."
"Go on."
"When I stopped breathing and became unconscious, he somehow lifted me onto a gunny and ran me up here to the infirmary. They got me going again in a hurry, and when I woke up, I realized immediately what he had done."
"What do you think he did?" I remember saying to myself as I asked him this, "I must
be a psychiatrist. It was all I could do not to laugh.
He taught me a lesson I'll never forget.
Which was?
That dying is nothing to fear. In fact, it's quite pleasant.
How so?
Well, you've heard that old adage, when you die, your life passes before your eyes. Well, it does, but only the good parts. In my case, I was a child again. It was wonderful. My mother was there, and my dog. And I had all my old toys and games, and my catcher's mitt. It was just like living my whole childhood over again. But it was no dream. It was really happening. All those memories, I never realized what a wonderful thing childhood is until I got the chance to relive it like that. And then, when I was 9, it started all over again, and again, over and over again. It was the best thing that ever happened to me.
There he was, his skin pale as a scallop, laughing about the event whose prospect had terrified him all his life.
I can hardly wait for the real thing.
They had taken Howie to Ward 4. I let him stew there the rest of that day and most of the next before I found time to talk to him. I was angry with him and let him know it. But he just sat there, beaming at me, his grin a perfect copy of Prout's know-it-all smirk. As he was heading back to his room on Ward 2, he turned and proclaimed,
"Prout says one more task and I'll be cured, too."
"I'll decide that, goddammit," I shouted after him.
One of the night nurses told me later that the Duchess had begun to take some of her meals in the dining room with the other patients. She was shocked and offended by all the belching and farting, courtesy primarily of Chuck, but to her great credit, she usually stuck it out. At her first appearance, Bess tried to get up and serve her. One glance from Prout and she returned to her place. As usual, however, she wouldn't eat anything until everyone else had finished.
"How did he get her to come to the table?" I asked the nurse.
"She wants to be the one who gets to go with him,"
came the obvious reply. She sounded envious. Session 12. While Prout was munching peaches and plums, I brought up the subject of Howie and his tasks. I explained that the first one he had assigned to him, to find the bluebird of happiness, had produced a positive effect not only on Howie but on the rest of the ward as well. Though it had turned out successfully also, the second, to cure Ernie, was more problematical. I asked him if he had anything else in mind for my patient.
"Only one final task."
"Do you mind telling me what it is?"
"That would spoil the surprise."
"I think we've had enough surprises around here for a while. Can you guarantee this task will cause no harm to anyone?"
"If he does it well, it will be a very happy day for everyone, including yourself."
I was not so certain about that, but my doubts were swallowed up by his self-confidence. "My father once lay down on the living room floor and asked me to make a run at him. He wanted me to push off on his knees, flip over him, and land on my feet above his head. It sounded like suicide. Trust me, he said. So I put my life in his hands, made a run at him, and with his help, miraculously landed on my feet. I never did it again. Prout had the same trust me look in his eyes when he told me about Howie's last task, and on that note we began our 12th session. The minute I started to count, Prout fell into a deep trance. I asked whether he could hear me.
Of course.
Good. Now, I want you to think back to the year 1979. That is, 1979 on Earth. It's Christmas Day, 1979. Where are you, and what do you see?
I am on the planet Tercipian, in what you would call the constellation Taurus. I see orange and green everywhere. I love it. I just love it. The flora on this world are not chlorophyll-based as they are on Earth and Capax. Instead, light is gathered by a pigment similar to that of your red algae. The sky is green because of the chlorine in the atmosphere. There are all kinds of interesting beings, most of whom you would characterize as insects. Some are bigger than your dinosaurs. All of them are quite slow-moving, fortunately, but you have
Excuse me, Prote, I would love to hear about this planet and all the other places you have visited, but right now I would prefer to concentrate on your passages to Earth.
Anything you say, but you asked me where I was and what I was doing on Christmas of 1979.
Yes, I did, but only as a point of reference. What I'd like to ask you to do now is to come forward in time to your next visit to Earth. Can you do that?
Of course. Let's see. January? No, I was still on Tercipian. February? No, I was back on Capax then. Learning to play the patois, though I'll never be any good at it. It must have been in March. Yes, it was March. That delightful time in your northern hemisphere when the ice on the streams is melting and the May apples and crocuses are coming up.
This is March 1980?
Precisely.
And he called you?
Well, not for anything in particular. He just wants someone to talk things over with now and then.
Tell me about him. What's he like? Is he married?
Yes, he's married to a girl he knew in... Oh, I told you about that already, didn't I?
The Catholic girl who was pregnant when they were seniors in high school?
What a memory. She's still a Catholic, but no longer pregnant. That was 5.5 years ago.
I've forgotten her name.
I never told you her name.
Can you tell me now? After a lengthy hesitation, during which he seemed to study my haircut, or the need thereof, he said quietly,
Sarah.
Barely concealing my elation, did they have a son or a daughter?
Yes.
I mean which?
You should do something about that sense of humor, Dr. Brewer.
A daughter. So she's about 5.
Her birthday is next week.
Any other children?
No, Sarah developed endometriosis and they gave her a hysterectomy. Stupid.
Because she was so young.
No, because there is a simple treatment for it that your medical people should have figured out long ago.
Can you tell me the daughter's name? Or is that a secret? After only a moment's hesitation.
Rebecca.
When this was divulged so readily, I wondered whether Pete had relented and had decided to allow Prote to tell me his real name. Perhaps he was beginning to trust me. But Prote must have anticipated my question.
Forget it,
he said. Forget what?
He's not going to tell you that.
Why not? Will he at least tell me why not?
No.
Why not?
You'll just use the answer to chip away at him.
All right. Then tell me this. Do they live in the same town he was born in?
Yes and no.
Can you be more specific?
They live in a trailer outside of town.
How far outside of town is it?
Not far. It's in a trailer park. But they want to get a house farther out in the country.
A shot in the dark. Do they have a sprinkler?
A what?
A lawn sprinkler.
In a trailer park?
All right. Do they both work? His mouth puckered slightly, as if the fruit hadn't agreed with him.
He has a full-time job, as you would call it. She earns some money making children's clothing.
Where does your friend work?
The same place his father and his grandfather did, just about the only place in town there is to work, unless you're a grocer or a banker.
The slaughterhouse?
Yes, sir. The old butchery.
What does he do there?
He's a knocker.
What's a knocker?
The knocker is the guy who knocks the cows in the head so they don't struggle so much when you cut their throats.
Does he like his job?
Are you kidding?
What else does he do, at home, for example?
Not much. He reads the newspaper in the evening, after his daughter has gone to bed. On weekends, he tinkers with his car and watches TV like everybody else in town.
Does he still hike in the woods?
Sarah would like him to do that, but he doesn't.
Why not?
It depresses him.
Does he still collect butterflies?
He threw out his collection a long time ago. There was no room for it in the trailer.
Does he regret his decision to get married and raise a family?
Oh, no. He is truly devoted to his wife and daughter, whatever that means.
Tell me about his wife.
Cheerful, energetic, dull, like most of the housewives you see at the A&P.
And the daughter?
A carbon copy of her mother.
Do they all get along well?
They idolize one another.
Do they have a lot of friends?
None.
None?
Sarah's a Catholic. I told you, it's a small town.
They never see anyone else?
Only her family and his mother.
What about his sisters?
One lives in Alaska. The other is just like everyone else in town.
Would you say he hates her?
He doesn't hate anyone.
What about male friends?
There ain't none.
What about the bully and the kid he beat up on?
One is in prison, the other was killed in Lebanon.
And he never stops off at a tavern after work for a beer with his fellow knockers?
Not anymore.
He did earlier?
He used to joke around with the others, have a beer or two, but whenever he invited someone for supper, they always found some excuse not to come. And no one ever invited him and his family for a barbecue or anything else. After a while, he began to get the idea. Now they stick to their trailer most of the time. I tried to tell him this would happen.
Sounds like a pretty lonely existence.
Not really. Sarah has a million brothers and sisters.
And now they're going to buy a house.
Maybe, or build one. They've got their eye on a few acres of land. It's a beautiful spot, a part of a farm that someone split up. It has a stream and a couple of acres of trees. A lovely place. Reminds me of home, except for the stream.
Tell him I hope he gets it.
I'll do that, but he still won't tell you his name.
At that point, Mrs. Trexler barged in, out of breath, whispering frantically about a disturbance in the psychopathic ward. Someone had kidnapped Giselle. I quickly hushed her up and reluctantly brought Prout back from his hypnotic state, left him with Mrs. T, and took off for the fourth floor. Giselle, it's hard to express the feelings I had in the few seconds it took me to make it downstairs. I couldn't have been more distressed if it had been Abby or Jenny in the hands of whichever lunatic had grabbed her. I saw her slouched down in my office chair, heard her childish voice, smelled her sweet piney scent. Giselle, all my fault, all my fault, allowing a helpless girl to cruise the corridors of the psych ward. I tried not to imagine a pair of hairy arms wrapped around her neck, or worse. I banged into four. Everyone was milling around or chatting amiably, some even beginning to return to their regular routines. I couldn't believe how unconcerned they seemed to be. All I could think of was, what kind of people are these? The kidnapper's name was Ed. He was a balding, white, 50-year-old man who had gone berserk 6 years earlier and gunned down 8 people with a semi-automatic rifle in a shopping mall parking lot. Until that time, he had been a successful stockbroker, a model husband and father, sports fan, church elder, 6-handicap golfer, and all the rest. Afterward, even with regular medication, he suffered periods of episodic discontrol accompanied by a significant electrical activity in his brain, which usually ended with utter exhaustion and fists bloodied by pounding them against the walls of his room. But it wasn't Giselle he had kidnapped, it was La Belle. I never did find out whether Mrs. Trexler's tongue had slipped or whether I misheard her. I'd been worried about Giselle's safety all along. In any case, the kitten had gotten into the psychopathic ward, and when the orderlies opened Ed's door to take away his dirty laundry, she slipped inside. It wasn't long before he was banging on the bars of his window and threatening to wring La Belle's little neck unless he could talk to the guy from outer space. Billers was there to remind me that he had opposed the idea of having animals in the wards, and perhaps he was right. This would never have happened without the kitten, and furthermore, if anything happened to it, the effect on Bess and the others could be quite demoralizing. I thought Ed was bluffing. He was not in one of his violent phases, but I could see no compelling reason not to let him talk briefly with Prout. and I asked Betty to send for him. Prout, however, was already there. Apparently he had followed me down the stairs. There was no need to explain the situation, only to tell him to assure Ed there would be no reprisal if he let the kitten go free. Prout, requesting that no one accompany him, headed for Ed's room. I assumed they would talk through the barred window, but suddenly the door opened and Prout darted inside, slamming it behind him. After a few minutes, I cautiously approached the window and peered into the room. They were standing over by the far wall, talking quietly. I couldn't hear what they were saying. Ed was holding La Belle, stroking her gently. When he glanced toward me, I backed off. Prout finally came out, but without the kitten. After making sure the security guard had locked Ed's door, I turned to him, puzzled. Anticipating my question, he said,
"He won't harm her."
"How do you know that?"
"He told me."
"Uh-huh. What else did he tell you?"
"He wants to go to K-Pax."
"What did you tell him?"
"I said I couldn't take him with me."
"What did he say to that?"
"He was disappointed until I told him I would come back for him later."
"And that satisfied him?"
"He said he would wait if he could keep the kitten."
"But..."
"Don't worry, he won't hurt her. And he won't cause you any more trouble either."
"How can you be so sure of that?"
"Because he thinks that if he does, I won't come back for him. I would anyway, but he doesn't know that."
"You would? Why?"
"Because I told him I would. By the way,"
he said as we were walking out together,
"you'll need to find a few more furry beings for the other wards."
Here was Howie's final task. To be ready for anything. To respond at a moment's notice to whatever Prout, without warning, might challenge him with. For a day or two, he raced at tachyon speed from the library to his room and back to the library. Same old Howie. He didn't sleep for 48 hours. He was reading Cervantes, Schopenhauer, the Bible. But suddenly, as he was darting past the lounge window where he had spotted the bluebird, he stopped and took his old seat on the ledge. He began to chuckle, then to roar. Pretty soon the whole ward, except perhaps for Bess, was giggling. Then the whole hospital, staff and all. The absurdity of Prout's charge, that he be ready for anything that might possibly happen, had sunk in.
"It's stupid to try to prepare for life,"
Howie told me later on the lawn.
"It happens, and there isn't a damn thing you can do about it."
Prout was over by the side wall examining a sunflower. I wondered what he saw in it that we didn't. "What about your task?" I asked him. "Que sera sera," he whistled, leaning back to soak up the warm sunshine.
"I think I'll take a nap."
I suggested he think about the possibility of moving to Ward 1.
"I'll wait until Ernie's ready," he said.
The problem was that Ernie didn't want to leave. I had already proposed at the last staff meeting that Ernie be transferred to one as well. He had shown no sign of the debilitating phobia since his cure. No mask, no complaints about the food, no hog-tying himself at night or sleeping on the floor. He was, in fact, spending most of his time with the other patients, particularly Bess and Maria. He had already become quite adept at recognizing the latter's various alters, learning all their names and characteristics, waiting patiently for the real Maria to make an appearance, then going out of his way to keep her around, gently encouraging her interests in needlepoint and macrame. It was obvious that Ernie had a talent for helping others, and I encouraged him to consider going into one of the health or social professions. His reply was,
"But there's so much that needs to be done here."
It was about this time that Chuck organized an essay contest to decide who would be the one to go with Prout on August 17th. The plan called for submission of all entries by August 10th, a week before his departure, a date that was rapidly approaching. Prout had apparently agreed to read all the essays by the 17th. Several staff members noted that Ward 2 was unusually quiet during that two-week period, with everyone sitting off by him or herself, thinking hard, bending over periodically to write something down. The only patients who didn't seem to want to go to K-Pax were Ernie and Bess. Ernie, because there was work to be done here, and Bess because she felt she didn't deserve a free trip, and of course Russell, who called the contest the work of the devil. Session 13. Ever since she ran off to Texas with a guitar player at the age of 15, my daughter Abby has been a vegetarian. She won't wear fur either, and has long opposed the use of animals in medical research. I've tried many times to explain to her the benefits to mankind of the latter endeavor, but her mind is closed on the subject. "Explain that to all the dead dogs," is her standard reply. We haven't discussed the subject in years. Abby once gave me a taped recording of whale songs. At the beginning of session 13, while Prout was digging into a watermelon, I played it for him. He stopped chewing and tilted his head to one side, much as Shasta had done when she had heard the same tape. By the time it was over, he was grinning even more broadly than usual. A piece of the rind was stuck in his teeth. I said, "Can you make anything out of that?" "Of course." "What is it? Is it some kind of communication?" "What did you think it was? Stomach gas?"
"Can you tell me what they're saying?"
"Sure."
"Well?"
"They're passing on all kinds of very complex navigational data, temperature and solute and food type and distribution charts and lots of other things, including some poetry and art. It is rich in imagery and emotion, which you would probably dismiss as sentimental."
"Can you give me a literal translation of all that?"
"I could, but I won't."
"Why not?"
"Because you would use it against them."
I felt a certain amount of resentment at being held personally responsible for the decimation of many of the world's cetaceans, but could think of no good reply.
"There was also a message for all the other beings on the planet."
He paused here, peering at me out of the corner of an eye, and took another bite of fruit.
"Well, are you going to tell me what it was? Or are you going to keep that a secret, too?"
"They're saying, let's be friends."
He finished the melon, counted 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and was out like a light.
"Comfortable?" I said when I realized he had already hypnotized himself.
"Perfectly, my dear sir."
"Good." I took a very deep breath. "Now I'm going to give you a specific date, and I want you to remember where you were and what you were doing on that day. Do you understand?"
"Jawohl."
"Excellent." I braced myself. "The date is August 17th, 1985. There was no hint of shock or other emotion.
"Yes," was all he said.
"Where are you?"
"I'm on Capax, harvesting some cropins for a meal."
"Cropins?"
"Cropins are fungi. Something like your truffles. Big truffles. Delicious. Do you like truffles?"
I was a bit annoyed by his attention to trivia at a time like this, though it was I who had pursued the topic. "I've never had truffles, but let's get on with this, shall we? Is anything else happening? Any calls from Earth?"
"There it is now, as a matter of fact, and I'm on my way."
"What did it feel like when the call came?"
"He needed me. I felt that he needed me."
"And how long will it take you to get to Earth?"
"No time at all. You see, at Tachyon speed, time goes backwards, so that..."
"Thank you. You've already explained to me all about light travel."
"Funny, I don't remember doing that. But then you must know it takes no time at all."
"Yes, I had forgotten. So now you are on Earth."
"Yes, on Zaire."
"Zaire?"
"It is pointing toward Capax at this moment."
"And now you'll be heading for..."
"And now I am with him."
"Your friend?"
"Yes."
"Where are you? What is happening?"
"By a river in back of his house. It is dark. He is taking off his clothes."
"He called you to Earth to go for a nighttime swim with him?"
"No. He's trying to kill himself."
"Kill himself? Why?"
"Because something terrible has happened."
"What happened?"
"He doesn't want to talk about it."
Damn it, I'm trying to help him.
He knows that.
Then why won't he tell me?
He feels terribly hurt and ashamed. He doesn't want you to know.
But I can't help him unless he tells me what happened.
He knows that, too. Then why? Because then you'd know what even he doesn't want to know.
Do you know what happened?
No.
No. Doesn't he tell you everything that happens to him?
Not anymore.
Then will you help him? If you can get him to tell me what happened, you would be taking the first step towards helping him deal with it.
No.
Why not?
He doesn't want to talk about it, remember?
But time's running out for him.
Time is running out for everyone.
All right, what is happening now?
He is floating down the river. He is drowning. He wants to die.
Prout stated this matter-of-factly, as if he were a disinterested observer.
Can't you stop him?
What can I do?
You could talk to him, help him.
If he wants to die, that's his right, don't you think?
But he's your friend. If he dies, you'll never see him again.
I am his friend. That is why I won't interfere.
All right, is he unconscious?
Almost.
But still in the water?
Yes.
There is still time. Help him, for God's sake.
There is no need. The stream has washed him onto the bank. He will survive.
How far downstream did it carry him?
Just a few jarts, a mile or so.
What is he doing now?
He's coughing. He's full of water, but he's coming around.
And you are with him?
As close as I am to you right now.
Can you talk to him?
I can talk to him, but he won't talk to me.
What is he doing now?
He's just lying there.
At this point, Prout took off his shirt and lay it on the floor in front of him.
You covered him.
He's shivering.
Prout lay down on the carpet beside his shirt. You are lying down beside him.
Yes, we're going to sleep now.
Yes, you do that. And now I'm going to ask you to come forward in time to the next morning. The sun is up. Where are you now?
Still lying here.
He is sleeping?
No, he just doesn't want to get up.
Did he say anything during the night?
No.
Did you say anything to him?
No.
All right, now it's late afternoon. Where are you now? Prout got up and returned to his chair.
In Zaire.
Zaire? How did you get to Zaire?
It's difficult to explain. You see, light has certain...
What I meant was, why did you go back there? Is your friend with you?
It looked like a beautiful country. I thought some sightseeing might cheer him up.
Did you talk to him about it?
Yes, I said... Let's get out of here.
What did he say?
Nothing.
So now you're in Zaire?
Yes.
Both of you?
Yes.
What will you do next?
Get to know the beings here.
And then what?
We'll move on to another place.
All right. It's 6 months later, February 17th, 1986. Where are you?
Egypt.
Still in Africa.
It's a big continent, by Earth standards anyway.
Is your friend still with you?
Of course.
What did you use for money on these travels?
Nothing. We just took what we needed.
And nobody objected?
Not after I explained who we were.
All right. It's 1 year after you left the river. August 17, 1986. Where are you now?
Sweden.
Do you like it there?
Very much. They are more like Capaxians here than anywhere else we've been.
In what way?
They're less warlike and more tolerant toward their fellow beings than the other countries we've visited.
August 17th, 1987.
Saudi Arabia.
August 17th, 1988.
Queensland, Australia.
August 17th, 1989.
Bolivia.
October 17th, same year.
The United States, Indiana.
December 17th,
New York.
February 17th, 1990.
The Long Island Psychiatric Hospital.
May 17th.
The Manhattan Psychiatric Institute.
The present.
Same old place.
And your friend hasn't spoken to you in all this time?
Nary a word.
Have you tried to talk to him?
Occasionally.
May I try?
Be my guest.
I need a name. It would be so much easier if you would give me a name to call him.
I can't do that, but I'll give you a hint. He can fly.
Fly? Is his name Fred?
Come on, you can do better than that. Can't you think of anything that flies besides airplanes?
He's a bird. He has the name of a bird.
Bingo!
Donald? Woody? Jonathan Livingston?
Those aren't real birds, are they, Gene?
Martin? Jay?
You're getting warmer.
Robin, Robert.
Well done, Dr. Brewer. The rest is up to you.
Thank you. I'd like to speak to him now. Do you mind?
Why should I?
Suddenly, Robert slouched down in his chair. His hands fell limply to his sides. Robert? No response. Robert, this is Dr. Brewer. I think I can help you. No response. Robert, listen to me. You've had a terrible shock. I understand your pain and suffering. Can you hear me? No response. At this point, I took a chance. Knowing Prode and, through him, something about Robert, I could not shake the feeling that if he had in fact hurt or killed someone, it must have been an accident or, more likely, perhaps, self-defense. It was mostly speculation, but it was all I had. Robert, listen to me. What happened to you could have happened to anyone. It is not something to be ashamed of. It is a normal response that human beings are programmed to carry out. It's in our genes. Do you understand? Anyone might have done the same thing you did. Anyone would condone what you did and why you did it. I want you to understand that. If you will just acknowledge that you hear me, we can talk about it. We don't have to talk about what happened just yet, only about how we can get you to overcome your grief and self-hatred. Won't you talk to me? Won't you let me help you? We sat silently for several minutes while I waited for Robert to make a move, a small gesture to indicate he had heard my plea. But he never twitched a muscle. I'm going to ask you to think about it for a while. We'll talk about this again a week from today, all right? Please trust me. No response. I'm going to ask to speak with your friend now. In a twinkling, Prote was back, wide-eyed and smiling broadly.
Hiya, Gene. Long time no see. How you been?
We talked a bit about our first few meetings back in May, the tiniest details of which he described perfectly, as if he had a tape recorder inside his head. I woke him and sent him back to Ward 2. Cheerful as ever, he didn't remember a thing about what had just transpired. There was a seminar that afternoon in our lecture room, but I didn't hear a word of it. I was considering the possibility of increasing the number of sessions with Prote Robert. Unfortunately, I had a meeting in Los Angeles at the end of that week and the beginning of the next, something that had been arranged months before and would have been impossible to get out of.
but I suspected that even a dozen more sessions wouldn't be enough. Maybe